Well, good morning, Sunnyside.
Good morning.
And I'm going to begin today by asking you, if you have a Bible, open it up. If you use an electronic version or however you do it, open it up to Matthew chapter 7. Matthew chapter 7. And I'm going to be reading the portion we're going to be looking at here this morning. So Matthew chapter 7, beginning in verse 24. Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise person who built their house on the rock. The rain came down, the streams rose, the winds blew and beat against that house, yet it did not fall, because it had its foundation on the rock. But everyone who hears these words of mine and does not put them into practice is like a foolish person who built their house on sand. The rain came down, the streams rose, the winds blew, they beat against that house, and it fell with a great crash. When Jesus finished saying these things, the crowds were amazed at his teaching, because he taught as one who had authority, and not as their teachers of the law. This morning, I want to be able to take a look at this passage with you, and just to be able to enter into it, because I believe that it has some incredible truths that it's trying to tell us in terms of how we build our story, how we even look at our story, and how our story manages to be able to become resilient. The first thing that Jesus starts off with is by telling us here that anyone who hears these words, everyone who hears these words, and puts them into practice, And then he's going to lay down two examples for us about that. But he lays it down and he says to us, hear them. In other words, hear. Honestly, take them in. And then he says, and put them into practice. And the Greek word there means not a one-off, not just a one-time thing where you do it. But it's saying, put them into everyday practice. Make it a part of your lives. And realizing that Jesus is using these words that he's telling us here as a summary at the end of the Sermon on the Mount. And so he obviously is taking a whole lot of the things that he's spoken about already, and now he's bringing it back down and saying, hey, here's the most important thing. You have to be able to live this. You have to be able to live this truth. For most of us, as we look at the Sermon on the Mount, the honest truth is, it doesn't sound that radical. Some of it does. Some of it sounds like, wow, that's kind of revolutionary. That's kind of different. That's a different way to approach life, a different style. But for the people of the day, when Jesus was saying these words, it was completely radical. Completely radical. They're looking at it and going like, really? Are you, what, this? Seriously? This is where this goes? I mean, starting off with certain little things even. Blessed are the poor. Well, everybody knew back then that blessed are the rich. I mean, I think we could probably still say the same thing today. But they believed it because they believed that if you were rich and well off, that was because God was blessing you. When Jesus said it's going to be very hard for the rich person to get into heaven, his disciples were aghast. They were going like, well, then who can make it? Who can make it? And Jesus goes ahead here and says, blessed are the poor. And the word blessed there in the Greek can also be translated there flourishing. Flourishing are the poor. And then he goes on to be able to say that, hey, if your righteousness isn't greater than the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, who believed that they were indeed blessed by God because they upheld everything within his law, they lived the right way. And Jesus says, if your righteousness, if you live in the right way, isn't greater than theirs, you're not getting into the kingdom of heaven. And also what he was saying was, and they're not either. You're not getting there because you've chosen what you think is the right way to live according to the rules and the law. He goes on from there and tells us that our thoughts are equal to our actions. He goes on and tells us too, he says, I want you to, you have to give even when it hurts. And then he tells them something that would have been oh my goodness, this is too much. Love your enemies. Love your enemies. See, the Messiah was supposed to come and throw the power and authority of Rome from them. Take it away. And make Israel once again a great nation. And Jesus is saying, you need to love these guys. You need to love them. He then goes on further and he says, oh, by the way, he says, and this one's going to be a hard one. He says, you need to forgive or you won't be. You need to forgive or you won't be. He then goes on even further and he says, hey, and I want you to be able to appreciate something. He says, not everyone who says, Lord, Lord, actually knows me. Actually knows me. And then he gives us two beautiful parts in the Sermon on the Mount where he says, this is the kind of relationship that I'm talking about with you that I want you to have. And first one of the two passages I'm just going to highlight here for you is the one where he says, and that, if you, being a good father, in other words, he is making an assumption here, and that, he's saying, you being a good father, a father who knows how to be able to love their kids, if you then, being a good father, and your kid comes up to you and says, can I have a piece of bread? Because they're hungry, and you give them a stone. He says, or he says, they ask for a piece of fish, and you give them something poisonous to eat. He says, you wouldn't do that. You wouldn't do that. And he says, and you are evil. Now, how's that for a classification for all of us? And that. But the word evil there means you are incapable of being perfect in either word or action. You're incapable of being perfect in either word or action. And by the way, that was something I told my boys over and over again as they grew up. Your father is incapable of being perfect in either word or action. So lower your expectations. Anyway, but then he says, but my father in heaven, he really knows how to love. He really knows how to love. And he wants to take care of you. Jesus goes on even further from there. And that he tells us in another part of the Sermon on the Mount, he says, be anxious for nothing. Don't be worrying all the time. Don't be worrying about what you're going to eat, what you're going to drink, what you're going to wear. And then he puts it into these beautiful words. He says, because my Father in heaven knows that you need these things. He knows already that you need them. So this is blowing everybody's mind back then, not yours, but everybody back then. It's blowing their mind because they could see God as the Father of the nation. They could see that. But Jesus was bringing it back down into the individual person, that each one of you can know him as Father. And not only as a father, but a father who loves you, who cares for you, has compassion for you, is forgiving, gracious, and most importantly, knows your needs. These are the words that Jesus is saying to them. I want you to be able to understand, put these into practice. So now we're going to go into the next part of the passage here. You good with me? Going to follow with me? Has the opening been clear enough? We're good with it? Yes? Okay. All right. I'm going to reverse the order here just a little bit in terms of the verses that we're going to be taking a look at. But catch this with me, please. The first thing here I want you to be able to appreciate here, and that is that the very end of the passage, Jesus, the people there at the time say about Jesus, they say, who is this guy? He speaks as one who has authority. And the Greek word there is exousia, and it means an empowerment and the right to use that power. So they recognize something. You not only are saying things, you're saying they're true, but we believe that not only are they true, you make them powerful. You make this truth powerful. And Jesus starts here by saying to us, and that, there is a person, he says, who wanted to build a house, and they built their house on a foundation of sand. I know nothing about engineering. I know nothing about construction. That's the honest truth. And I'm dangerous with a tool in my hand. But I want you to be able to appreciate something. I have talked to enough people to be able to know that if you build your house on sand, it has bad consequences. It doesn't go well for you because everything can shift. Now, I want you to be able to appreciate this too. In other words, the person did build their house. And by the house is symbolic of our story that we live. And the story looked good. It looked good. Maybe even looked desirable to a bunch of the neighbors and to the people around them. It looked good. But then came the storm. Then came the storm. The storm with its wind, its rain, its shattering movements and power. And by the way, a storm meant to destroy you. A total storm meant to destroy you. And it does. The foundation shifts. The house collapses. That which they were building their house upon was sand. Now, The illustration I want to be able to give for you here this morning, and that I feel best captures this whole idea of what does it mean, this foundation that is built upon sand. And honestly, the best description I think comes from Genesis chapter 3. You can turn there if you want and follow with me. But basically, it is the description of Adam and Eve and their fall in the Garden of Eden. And realizing that the garden that they were placed in was a place of unbelievable beauty. Unbelievable, everything was there. And it was empowered by the presence of God. It was everything you could ever desire. As a matter of fact, the Hebrew word there that's used for the Garden of Eden, in the Greek version of the Hebrew word, Jesus uses it to be able to use it this way when he says to the thief on the cross, I tell you the truth, this very day you will be with me in paradise. In other words, the Garden of Eden was paradise. It was paradise. Except for one tree. One tree in the middle of the garden. The tree of the knowledge of good and evil. The one tree they were told, do not eat the fruit from this tree. Then along comes the serpent, who is Satan. And he comes along and he says, did God really say? Did God really say? And he simply plants the seed of doubt. He simply plants the seed of doubt. Did God really say that you shouldn't do this? You shouldn't do that? And then he plants it even further by saying, well, God knows that when you eat of that tree, the fruit of that tree in the center of the garden, God knows you'll be like him. You'll be like God. Eve is standing there in the center of the garden. She's looking at the fruit, and I want you to catch these two things that are important about this. The fruit looked good. It looked good. It looked desirable. And it could provide you with something that maybe you were missing. It looked good. Now, here's one way that you know that I am not the one who would have designed this tree in the center of the garden. Because if I had designed the tree in the center of the garden, you would have looked at this fruit. It would have been moldy, filled with maggots. It would have had an odor that was just repulsive. And you never would have thought of touching it, never mind putting it in your mouth. But God makes a tree with a fruit that is desirable. And the more she looks at it, the more she realizes, I'd really like a taste of it. I would really like a taste of it. And she does. And she gives some to Adam, who is with her. And their eyes are open. And for the first time in their life, they feel shame. They feel shame. And when God comes looking for them later in the garden, and that, I want you to be able to understand this. The most important thing that they lost at that point, surrounded by all the blessings that God could possibly provide, they believed a lie. And that which was built in their story was built on sand from that point on. And I'm just going to take you to this one other point here. It's a little rabbit trail in that. And that is this. When God comes down and it says, as was his habit, he walked with them in the garden every day, as was his habit. And he opens up with these words, a God who is all-knowing, omniscient. And he opens up with these words, where are you? Where are you? And I can tell you right now, you can't just simply read those words without hearing God's heart breaking. And he asks the same question of each one of us. Where are you in your story right now? Because it's only as we're willing to be seen that he's able to come and make that difference. That to me is the greatest example of when we build our life not on truth, but on lies. And I need you to be able to understand something. The enemy wants your destruction. He wants your destruction. He wants your life destroyed because you've been made in the image of God, and he hates that. He hates that. So the house, built on a foundation, built on sand, it collapses. It comes down. Now let's look at the one that's built upon a rock. Let's look at the one that's built upon a rock. It's going to be more positive, right? Is this going to be more positive? Some of you, I think, are hoping so anyway. Okay? And that. So let's go there. So now you got the house that's built upon a foundation of rock. It's got stability. It's got security. It's got that strength that comes from that. And Jesus is letting himself be known by hereby too, the fact that, hey, I'm that rock. It's my truth that you're building this foundation on. It's my truth that you're building your story on. And it's solid. And the house is built on something solid. And then comes the storm. But let's all be understood here, right? And that because we are living the right way, because we're good people, because we're doing things the right way, that storm's not nearly as bad as the storm that hit the person who's built their life on a lie, right? I mean, that storm is less fierce, less dangerous, less damaging, right? No. Sorry? Sorry?
No.
Who said no? I'm going to get you to take over. No, I'm kidding. No, the answer is no, okay? The answer is definitely no. Don't be afraid sometimes to sit there and just because somebody's up here speaking means that they've got it all right. I do this, by the way, with youth when I'm speaking with them all the time until finally one of them will look at me and go, I don't think so. Why don't you think so? My mom told me that I don't think so. No, it's not. The storm is equally as damaging. It's equally as dangerous. It hates them. It's coming out to destroy them. And it's unleashing all of these powers to bring their story down and to destroy that story. Timothy Keller made this statement. He said, deep down, we cling to the simplistic idea that if we are good, life will go well. And then he writes in capital letters, untrue. Untrue. But when you and I are faced with the storm, what are we praying? What are we asking God? Keep us through the storm. Yeah. And I honestly wish that was the first prayer I prayed when I'm hitting the storms. But you want to know the truth? Transparently with you, I'm praying, Lord, take away the storm. Take away the storm. Lord, please, take away the storm. We sang that song up here a little while ago, and that just a little bit ago, and I'm terrible with songs and memories and verses, so help me out here, Amy. But I believe it says, I wish the mountains would move. I wish the waters would part that I could walk through. In other words, take away the stuff that looks like storms. Take it away. God, I wish you would do this sometimes. I wish you'd move those mountains. I wish you'd part the waters. I wish you'd make it easy for me to just be able to go through this moment in my life. I'm praying that God will stop the storm. That's what I'm praying. Go back to the passage that was read for us earlier by Bill. And it's a beautiful little story there. And it starts off by Jesus saying, let's go over to the other side. And everybody gets into the boat. And then they say, about halfway out there, it's in the middle of the night, around 3 o'clock in the morning, and it is dark, pitch black, and a storm comes up, and the rain's coming down, the wind's blowing, the waves are coming over and swamping the boat, and the boat's sinking. And Jesus is asleep in the boat. How tired do you have to be to sleep in that moment? How tired. But if you ever felt fatigue and wondered if he understands, he does. He does. And his disciples wake him up with these words, don't you care? Don't you care? We're drowning, you included. We're drowning. And it says he got up and literally he muzzles the storm. He muzzles it. And then he looks at them and he makes two statements. Why are you so afraid? You don't have a problem with that statement? I'm sorry, let me paint the scenario for you again, okay? You're in a boat in the middle of the night. It is pitch black, and a storm comes up, and the rain's falling down, and the wind's tossing you every which way. And even the guys who are professional fishermen had given up and realized we're going to die. And the boat's sinking. Do you not have a right to be afraid? Do you not have a right to be afraid? Why is that such a hard answer, a hard question to answer? Okay. Take it from me. You have the right to be afraid. You have the right to be afraid. So why did he make the statement? Why did he make the statement? Because he'd given a command at the beginning of the trip. Let us go over to the other side. Let us go over to the other side. Does he lie? Some of you in your experience might think, yeah, I'm not sure I could trust Jesus completely. But can I tell you something? He doesn't lie. So was he saying we're all going to the other side? That's why he fell asleep, because he knew what the destination was and that they'd make it. But then he makes a statement also, and he says, but where's your faith? You really don't trust me that when I say something, that it's true? You don't trust that when I make the declaration to you, that it's going to follow through? And by the way, he's promised to be there with you always. That's Jesus' word, his truth, part of the rock, the foundation you should be building your story upon. But he never promised it would be easy. He never promised it would be easy. In both these accounts, here, right now, at the end of Matthew 7, he says, and the storm came. And the storm came. There's never a promise it's going to be easy. But, yes, too often I pray, Lord, just take away the storm. And sometimes he's gracious to me. And he stands up in the boat, and he stops the storm. And he brings it to a hush. Brings it to perfect peace. Sometimes he does that for me. But then I always feel like he's asking me the next question. Where's your faith? If I said I could take you through this, where's your faith? Do you really trust me? Are the truths that you build your story upon really ones you trust and believe? Are you with me so far on this? Yeah? Should I start over? Okay. I have two little points here that I want to conclude with, okay? And that just two little examples that come from Scripture and which I think are just great examples of facing the storm. And so two examples from two different portions, and it's only going to take me another 30 minutes, so relax. The first one is this. How many of you have heard the story of David and Goliath? Good. Okay. Little guy takes on the big guy. And they're having this, going to have this battle, this epic battle. The guy who's almost 10 feet tall is taking on the kid who's just a boy and dressed like a shepherd. For 40 days, twice a day, Goliath shows up and gives the challenge, send me a man. We'll fight. That'll decide the battle, who becomes whose slave. And then David comes along. Do you think that for the 40 days in a row, the people who were up against Goliath were not praying, Lord, take away the storm? Do you not think that would have been a natural part of their prayer? Take away the storm, Lord. Take away the storm. Take this giant out of the storm. Lord, take this giant away. But if that had happened, you would never heard of the story of David and Goliath. You probably would have heard very little about David. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, told that they're just going to bow down with everybody else in front of a golden statue that Nebuchadnezzar had set up of himself, and you're going to worship it. You're going to show me how loyal you are to me. But if you don't, I'm throwing you into a fiery furnace. So you better bow down, heads to the ground. They don't. In the days leading up to this, because there was a long time for them to think about it, and in the hours leading up to the time where they'd have to make their stand and stay standing while everybody else bowed down. Just the three of them left standing. Do you not think they're praying, Lord, take away the storm? I would be praying, Lord, take away the storm. I would say, Lord, please get me out of here. Save, do something. Instead, it says that they are thrown into the fiery furnace. But they're not burned up. They're alive and healthy and well in the middle of a fiery furnace. And it says there's a fourth person in there too who looked like a god. It was probably Jesus. But if God had answered the prayers, take away the storm, we never would have heard this story. Do you realize that God has given every single one of you a story? It's the most beautiful thing in the world. He's given every single one of you a story. And that story is made up of the same thing. It's made up of words. If you really want to see your story changed, change your words. Change your words. If you keep living the same story, you're probably living it because you got the same words. So my encouragement to you this day, this morning is, and I invite the worship team to come on back up. But my encouragement to you this day is this. Why don't you look at the words that Jesus says, that Jesus spoke, the truths that he declared about himself, the promises that he made, and the fact that he says you can connect with the heart of the Father who loves you, cares for you, knows your needs, is compassionate, is gracious, and is forgiving. He says, I want you to get to know him. I want you to get to know him. And then you can believe my truths, and those truths can become the foundation upon which your story is built.